This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Everyone here is on notice. Everything you do will be picked apart until I discover who is on the level and who's a f***ing quisling.
Don't you get the rat scurry?
That's actor Damian Lewis as the deliciously evil Bobby Axelrod in the new Showtime series, Billions. Axelrod is a ruthless hedge fund manager and, publicly at least, a great philanthropist. Lewis stars alongside Paul Giamatti, who plays a U.S. attorney hell-bent on bringing him down. I think Damian Lewis only does complicated. For fans of Homeland, he's burned into our minds as Nicholas Brody, the Marine who was captured by Al-Qaeda and returns home a terrorist, and who incidentally drives Claire Danes' CIA character a little crazy. Lewis also starred in the Forsyte saga and in HBO's Band of Brothers. The New Yorker's Lauren Collins profiled Damian Lewis in the magazine and wrote, "Lewis sees himself as a champion for his characters, be they rapacious monarchs or domestic terrorists or capitalist pigs. Acting for him is analogous to mounting a case." So the two of them sat down at the New Yorker Festival last fall, where Lewis made the case for his Bobby Axelrod character.
So I am getting a little bit of a libertarian "don't tread on me" vibe from
How are you?
Bobby Axelrod.
Yeah, a little bit.
Is he a Trump voter?
He's close.
So we know that when you do Henry VIII or something like that, you go to Hampton Court Palace and you probably, you know, eat some mutton roasted on a spit and you walk around in your cod.
Throw it over my shoulder. Yeah.
That sort of thing. But what are you doing to immerse yourself in the world of New York hedge fund billionaires? Do you do the same kind of
One of the co-creators on this show is Andrew Russ Sorkin, who is the New York Times' leading financial journalist and wrote a fabulous book called Too Big to Fail. He's been a terrific source of information. He has access to all these guys. And so I've had wonderful meetings, actually, with Bill Ackman, Dan Loeb, Larry Robbins, some of the most powerful hedge fund guys here in the city. And there's a sort of self-mythologizing that goes on with them, I think, because they believe they're the underdog. Always, because in some ways they set themselves against the house. So if the house, the casino is Wall Street and they set the odds, these guys are resolutely not part of Wall Street and they're very keen to stress that.
When you go into their offices, what's the first thing you ask?
Where'd you buy your suit?
Yeah.
And they say Tom Ford. And they say, okay, that's because you can afford it. Because this is the new world of TV now where there's this novelistic form of storytelling where characters are now riddled with ambiguity. So everyone's an anti-hero. So every villain has likable parts to him. Every hero is compromised in some way. It's actually what is making TV so exciting at the moment. There's no Gary Cooper anymore and, you know, some bald guy stroking a cat. It's more complicated than that. And I asked them, I wanted an intellectual defense always. Give me your intellectual defense of being a hedge fund guy, of shorting companies. And the one thing they could never really persuade me of was that playing to a moral code that we might all conventionally understand, it wasn't possible to justify what they do. But if they just ever so slightly shifted the goalposts and created a new moral reality for themselves, which is essentially that as long as I don't break the law and as long as the game exists, I'm here to play the game. That's their justification. The one thing that I couldn't get out of any of them and which I quibble with is if you know, for example, the guys who shorted the market in 2007, 2008 during the subprime mortgage, if you knew the whole thing was so crocked, didn't you feel some sort of a moral obligation to wave the flag? And they just, there was so much money that they stood to make that they actually just, they just kept quiet.
Okay, so you're somewhere between God's Work and Vampire Squid.
Yes, exactly.
You're not totally decided yet.
Having said that, it is quite fun playing a billionaire.
I'm sure.
I've been on more yachts, private jets, and helicopters than in my entire life in the space of the last 2 months. So that's quite fun.
We're going to go back a little bit in time and watch a clip from one of your earliest projects, The Foresight Saga. Can we see that one?
Miss Heron, I have substantial income, and I'm currently looking for a commodious house in the region of Hyde Park. My family are of the very best. We are all professional people. And my expectations in respect of my father's property are the very highest. I am in good health. I have the honor, Miss Heron, of asking you for your hand in marriage.
How funny looks it.
So, I was reading some interviews you did at the time when it came out, and you said, you know, demographically for me, this wasn't so much of a stretch. I sort of knew this world, I knew this milieu. How did your familiarity with that world help you in that role?
That's a good question. I my mother, for example, was a Deb and came out in 1957, 55, I think, 55, 56, at the Dorchester Hotel in London at a time when these things were still reported in the Times. So I suppose in some respects I was born into a privileged, privately educated, you know, boarding schooled family. I say in some respects, I was. And I don't know, an experience of people with power, with money. Yes, I have grown up with those people. Spent quite a lot of my time trying to get away from them in order to do what I really wanted to do. But certainly, I suppose a certain deportment, knowing how to carry yourself. I went to a school I'm sure you've heard of, Eton College, and we wore tails and stiff collars. We no longer had to wear top hats, but we wore tail coats.
Casual
and striped
Friday,
trousers.
Eddie.
Yeah. Casual, exactly. Casual Friday was you just lost the waistcoat. You know,
right.
But that was you still had to wear the tails. Yeah, and you know, stiff starched collars, and so that character was, you know, of that milieu, and that's possibly why I made that comment.
Well, we have another Foresight clip.
Yeah. Okay.
So, if you couldn't commit the matter to paper,
keep your daughter away from my son. You probably know, they are together as we speak.
I had no idea.
They met at June's gallery. My son is staying with Val and Holly. Your daughter invited herself down, inveigled her way in.
Val Doughty and his wife extended Fleur an invitation.
She forced their hand. She must be like you. She sees something and decides to get it.
So what do you want me to do?
Make sure this doesn't happen again.
Stop it, you mean?
Absolutely.
You come here behind your son's back and tell me to break this up. You, of all people, the man who once lectured me on the importance of happiness in marriage, the man who spurned his own family to follow his heart, who stole another man's wife in the name of love.
John and your daughter aren't in love.
Have you asked them? This liaison is repugnant to me too, your son. With my daughter. I'll do my utmost to stop it, and I presume you will too. But at least I don't have to play the hypocrite. Good evening to you, sir.
So I look at this and I think, how great. But I know sometimes for creative people, going back to anything that you've done a long time ago is you know, anywhere from just you're indifferent or you're embarrassed. Or when you look at this, I mean, do you think your acting style has evolved or not since then?
I was quite pleasantly surprised by that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wasn't terrible. Laurence Olivier famously, you know, stole things all the time off people. He was a magpie, and some people even said, you know, uncharitably, that, you know, he was only really interested in meeting and befriending people who he was interested in for material for his own, for his next role. This, I arrived on set for the very first day's filming of the Forsyte saga with terrible, terrible stomach pains. And I'd been to see a doctor down in London, and they said, well, you've probably just got wind here. Just stick this up your rear end and everything will be fine. And I said, I thought they only do that in France. But anyway, okay. So I was, a week later, I was just in considerable pain. And we came to the first day's filming, and they, we had to stop at lunchtime because I went green. By that evening, I was in emergency in hospital because I had acute appendicitis. And everything had ruptured, and it was all a mess, and I was seconds away from peritonitis and all the other stuff that, you know, poisons you and kills you. So anyway, so I was out for 2 weeks, and I came back and realized that they had, there's a point to this story. I came back and realized that they had shot some wide shots of me on my back, and they'd used this guy, you know, sprayed his hair red and had him knock on a few doors. And this guy had this oddest walk, and he'd sort of walked along like this, like this. And I was furious. I said, well, this is ridiculous. You can't use this guy, and it should only be my image on the screen. And this is a wide shot, and you contract your lungs. And I watched it again. And then I just, and I nicked it, I stole it. And I kept this sort of, and that's where, from that scene, this rather sort of, you know, sort of thing came from Soames, when I just got, and I stole the whole thing, and it sort of rather unlocked the whole character for me, this incredible sort of tension that lived in him. And I still, to answer your question, do that. I still steal things and observe people and watch and, funnily enough, a little, just one article of clothing of your costume can unlock something for you. And then I'll do, you know, more quirky little things, like I for one role I wore a woman's thong for the whole film shoot instead of my own underwear.
That was homely.
It's uncomfortable,
clearly.
I'm here to tell you. But no, in a film called The Escapist, and I was playing the sort of leader of a sort of gang, the in prison gang, and it was a film with Brian Cox and everything. But he had this walk that I couldn't quite get, and I knew I wanted to get it, so I started wearing a woman's thong for my underwear, and I got the walk immediately. It was
that's
great.
The trick?
Yeah, well, it was for me, yeah. It was just sort of a bit like this. It just meant I just walked a bit more like this. Just, you know, because I had this woman's thong on, and it was, you know, if I didn't move quickly, it was going to cut me. So I had to just do that.
You went to the thong store and you were like, it's for a movie.
Yeah, no, I did. I just went and I had great fun. You guys have great underwear.
Is it way too boring for you to talk about the American accent because it's so extraordinary?
No, thank you.
When was the first time you came to America?
Well, actually, I cheated here as well. I was an insider. My aunt, my mother's brother, moved to Darien, Connecticut, and when we were all like 7, 8 years old. So, almost immediately, we, you know, packed our bags for summer vacations and came and visited them. So, the grilled cheese at the Darien Country Club, I'm here to tell you, is one of the greatest grilled cheeses I've ever had. So, I suppose America was very much part of my childhood. We watched American programs, just like every other, you know, kid around the world. You know, Dukes of Hazzard wins that one. And we went to a dude ranch in Wyoming. Which is one of the greatest vacations I ever had. And I wept uncontrollably when I had to say goodbye to Smokey, my pony. And then, yeah, and Band of Brothers came along, and I had a few American dialect lessons just to keep it, you know, just to get focused in. Actually, one of the veterans on the show who was one of our technical advisors who had actually served came up to me one day and he said, "Lewis, I got no f-ing idea what part of the States you're from, but you sound American and that's good enough for me." And from that moment on, I just kind of stuck with it because I didn't really know where I was from either.
Okay, let's watch a Homeland clip.
My name is Nicholas Brody, and I'm a sergeant in the United States Marine Corps. On May 19, 2003, as part of a two-man sniper team serving in Operation Iraqi Freedom, I was taken prisoner by forces loyal to Saddam Hussein. Those forces then sold me to an Al-Qaeda commander, Abu Nazir, who was operating a terrorist cell from across the Syrian border, where I was held captive for more than 8 years. I was beaten. I was tortured. And I was subjected to long periods of total isolation. People will say I was broken. I was brainwashed. People will say that I was turned into a terrorist, taught to hate my country. I love my country.
So amazing. What state was Brody supposed to be from? Did you have an idea about that, or was that?
Brody was more difficult. We didn't want him to have a southern accent. He was supposed to be blue collar, nondescript American.
President Obama invited you to the White House, pretty much, on the strength of that.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Unforgettable. It was really extraordinary. I tried to make a quip as I was being introduced to him. So I meet the president and I just say, it would be remiss of me, Mr. President, if I didn't ask on behalf of the writers, if you are going to go into Iran, please let us know so we can make season two as current as possible. And and just wished I hadn't said it almost immediately. And he looked at me and just right away with a twinkle in his eye and he said, "I'll be sure to let you know," and shook my hand. But almost as quickly, I just felt this enormous hand sort of whack me on the side. And he said, "There's this enormous security guy behind," went, "Move along, please, sir." Right, he sent me down. All I could hear is someone said Iran in the White House. He's talking, someone started talking to the president about Iran. And I know what was going on. And so, I was immediately a security risk. And
who did you sit next to?
Well, Helen, my wife, and I walked into this fantastic marquee set up on the south lawn of the White House and walked through the cherry blossoms, the Japanese cherry blossoms, and down to it. It was really extraordinary, exquisite. Looking for our seat, which we assumed would be next to the revolving doors going into the toilet or the kitchen or something. And walked around the whole room to arrive at top table, at table one, to find our places, with me realizing that I was sitting across from the President of the United States, from POTUS, and he'd sat me opposite him, with David Cameron on his left, the Vice Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces, Helen, my wife, was next to him, David Cameron, and then Michelle, someone called George Clooney, your George Clooney, on the other side, and had I known I was about to play a hedge fund billionaire, of course I'd have spent much longer talking to him. Warren Buffett on my left,
oh, wow.
And just had the president was charm and grace personified. He was relaxed. He made jokes. He even engaged myself and Warren Buffett in a three-way conversation about fracking at one point. I had a lot to say. And they listened intently. Some of that policy is now being put into effect.
Damien's law.
Yeah. But funny thing about Warren Buffett, who is the most delightful man, but the more wine I drank, the more he started to seem like Burgess Meredith. But anyway, so it was an extraordinary night.
Please join me in applauding Damien.
Damien Lewis spoke with New Yorker writer Lauren Collins. He plays a British intelligence agent in the film Our Kind of Traitor, based on a John le Carré novel. And it opens next month. Till then, you can just binge on season 1 of Billions.